Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon and have 10 different topics every week. If you'd like to find out what we'll be doing in the days ahead, check out our web archive and listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast. You can do any and all of that by going to our website. You can even listen that way through the website. We stream live on our AM, and you can hear all of that at Will, that's W-I-L-L, will.illinois.edu. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about some of the surprising connections between disease and longevity. Now, one of the most basic ideas in biology goes something like this. Genetic traits that help us to survive and to reproduce end up being passed on to those who comes after us. And those traits that make us less likely to survive and reproduce won't get passed on, at least they won't get passed on very long. That's called natural selection. So now the question comes, how do we explain hereditary disorders? Well, this morning we'll be talking with Dr. Sharon Moalem, who has written a book that's titled Survival of the Sickest, that looks at this very issue and, in fact, makes the argument that some conditions that we think of as health problems may actually have developed to help our ancestors to survive. The book is now available in paperback. It sold a lot of books and has some interesting things in it, so you might want to take a look at it. The current publisher is Harper Perennial, that of the paperback edition. Our guest, Sharon Moalem, holds Ph.D. in physiology and in the emerging fields of neurogenetics and evolutionary medicine. In his research, he's discovered a new genetic association for familial Alzheimer's disease. He's also published on the adaptive advantages of the genetic mutations that cause hemochromatosis, which is a disease that causes the body to accumulate iron, that and also diabetes. He continues to do this kind of research while finishing up his medical training at New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, as always, 3339455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Any point here, questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to keep their questions and comments brief, but anyone is welcome to join the conversation. Well, Dr. Moalem, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
That's great. Thank you for having me.
I guess the place to start is, as you do, with talking about hemochromatosis. What is that?
Well, up until recently, this is a little-known condition where you just absorb too much iron from the diet. Your body kind of acts like a magnet to the metal and kind of sucks up all the iron it can out of the food you eat. And over long term, that iron kind of makes its way into your bodily organs where it actually causes like oxidative damage. It kind of rusts out the organs. So the organs that typically tend to get hit the hardest is like liver, pancreas, and heart. And for many years, of course, this condition was thought to be very rare until genetics found out through looking at different populations that if your ancestry goes back to Europe, you have a 30% chance of having one gene or one mutation for this condition, which means that there's, you know, possibly millions of Americans who are at risk for having too much iron. And the problem is most physicians don't even test for iron, and you end up in your doctor's office for problems with your liver or diabetes because of the pancreatic damage or even heart disease.
Mm. And I think that in part your reason for being interested in this at all is because you have this in your family.
Exactly. This is a very personal story. When I was 15, my grandfather became very ill, first with diabetes and then Alzheimer's disease, which kind of, you know, sparked the science fair curiosity of a 15-year-old to start asking questions. You know, why did my healthy, strapping, strong grandfather come down with these conditions? Was it just old age? Are we just all meant to break down? And the one kind of thing that really stuck out in my mind, which was strange to me, of course, for a 15-year-old anyways, was he loved to give blood. He just kept talking about all the benefits that he got from giving blood. And it wasn't, you know, altruistic in his sake. He just had said physically he felt better. Which, of course, doesn't make any sense because, you know, you need your blood. And if you're transfusing it, you know, everyone could give up, you know, a little bit. But it kind of didn't make any sense to me. And the one thing with his health, the connection, when he turned 65, he stopped giving blood. And then noticed that, you know, that's when kind of he started going downhill health-wise, and he kept asking, he kept saying he needs to give blood. That would kind of be the panacea. And, of course, this was a running joke. Everyone was laughing at him. But I kind of took him seriously and said, you know, what is it in blood that could be making him feel better if he's giving it? And since, of course, iron is present in blood, it gives it its red color, could it be that my grandfather had too much iron? And at this time, the gene wasn't discovered yet and was considered a rare condition. And I went to his physician and, of course, you know, wasn't really taken seriously. And unfortunately, my grandfather, he passed away, but I kind of kept at it. And when the gene was discovered, I ended up doing research and finding a genetic association between having these genes that give you too much iron from that you absorb from your diet and familial Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm.
So this
and
is...
then, again, it started me asking questions. Why would 30% of Europeans have a gene that is detrimental? We're not talking about some kind of, you know, rare mutation. 30% is a big slice of the population. So I kind of went back and said, well, could there be any benefits to having this condition early on in life? And it turns out that if you do have these genes, you're very good at kind of locking away that iron away from organisms that are coming to infect you. And almost all bacteria that infects us is actually after our iron. They're mining us for our iron, so to speak, biologically. And having this condition, our body puts that iron into storage and locks it away and allows you to fight those organisms. And as you know, in history, you know, when the Black Plague, bubonic plague hit Europe in the 14th century and subsequent centuries, millions of people are thought to have died. We're talking, I think, estimates from 25 to 50 million. So some people survive. And what do those people have? I believe they had these genes specifically that lead to too much iron. So I started extending that and saying, you know, could it be that genes that cause, and we're not talking rare mutations, that cause things that are fairly common health complications, could they be evolutionary compromises? Could it be evolution's way of, you know, getting ourselves out of harm's way, but of course coming at a cost? And then I kind of went through, you know, everything from high cholesterol to certain types of cancers and made these kind of new and bold connections.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating sort of idea, and in this particular case, say with this disease that causes people to accumulate iron, that certainly would explain how it was that something that eventually is fatal or potentially fatal might actually have some advantage in this particular case. Again, if it would prevent people from getting this deadly disease and dying before they had children. If they died later, well, that really didn't matter. If it managed to get them at least through their child-producing period. And so that would explain how it is that something that is a genetically inherited, potentially, or maybe it's more than potentially fatal condition actually manages to hang around where you would, on the face of it, you'd think, well, what would happen was eventually people who had this, they would die out, they wouldn't have children, and eventually that would go away.
Right. And exactly. I mean, you really kind of summed it up nicely. And to kind of like also to take it a step further, classically, that's kind of people have viewed that, you know, if it's important what happens to you before you have kids. After you have kids, you're kind of worthless or useless. But as, you know, anyone knows who's had uncles and aunts or grandparents help out, you know, taking care of kids, I mean, having extra members in a societal group is very useful. For us. So there is this kind of argument that being able to survive someone into old age, even after you reproduce, might be helpful because, of course, if you're a grandparent, you're helping to sustain the genes that are in your grandchild, really. But what makes it interesting is, you know, could it be that a lot of these genes, by understanding how they protected us in the past, how the compromise arose, could it lead us to new treatments? And, for example, with this hemochromatosis issue, now I've kind of gone on and started developing drugs to fight superbugs such as MRSA based on these ideas by withdrawing iron, by pulling out the iron that they need to survive, just like a person with hemochromatosis does, but allow kind of and extend that to people who don't have those disease genes and to try to, you know, treat their infections.
Mm. Now, this I think this is a really interesting and highly plausible sounding kind of explanation of hemochromatosis and why it is that it would still be around.
Right.
Can you go beyond just telling what is a good story that's where people would say, well, you know, that actually sounds like that makes a lot of sense, to actually grounding that and saying, well, not only do I have a good story for you, but I've actually have I can really back that up and saying, yes, in fact, I think that really is, I have some data, I have some numbers, I have something that goes beyond the story that says, yeah, I think this is what's going on.
Right, and I think you really hit at the core of it, because at the end of the day, all good science needs data.
Hmm.
You know, you can philosophize and come up with theories all day long, but if you really want to make something and reduce it to practice, it's exactly what you need. And in the case with hemochromatosis, the way this was done, macrophages, which are kind of like the Pac-Man cells of the body that, you know, gobble up intruders, from people with hemochromatosis were challenged with bacteria. And what was seen was that the bacteria wasn't able to get the iron that it needed from these cells to be able to cause an infection. And of course, this was done, these are petri dishes and not, you know, whole animal experiments, but it's really kind of the first step in a long line of coming to a real understanding if, again, these are just theories. And what's important here is also, is not if my ideas pan out. Mm-hmm. You know, it could have been another organism that selected for this condition. I think what's interesting is, in trying to find out if my ideas are right or wrong, we'll uncover kind of new mechanisms and then, again, try to find new treatments. And another example is, I mean, the other idea that I worked on was diabetes. Which type 1, which is the juvenile form, and the much more deadly one, it tends to be most common in Northern Europe. And the big question was, you know, this is a case where a child comes down with this condition, and it's fatal. Why would it be very common in certain situations? And especially, these are populations that aren't stuck on an island. You know, Europe has had a lot of people kind of coming and going to be mixing in. And I started thinking about this when I came across this amazing frog called Rana sylvatica, the common wood frog. And it has the ability to freeze solid every winter. Its heart stops, its brain stops. The thing becomes a frogsicle, essentially. And it was discovered accidentally when a researcher left a bag of these frogs that he collected in the forest in the trunk of his car overnight, forgot to bring them into the lab, and there was a frost. And he came, opened up his trunk, and found a bag of frogsicles, frozen frogs, took it to his lab, was about to start dissecting them, decided to go make a coffee, got his coffee. By the time he came back, the frogs not only were thawed, they were alive and jumping around his lab. You can imagine the shock and horror that he didn't start dissecting them. So this amazing frog can become frozen and unfrozen and survive simply by becoming a diabetic, essentially, the frog version of diabetes. It's the frog's sugar levels go up by about 100-fold, and what it allows the frog to do is to turn itself, its insides, its liquids into a giant slushy or slurpy. And by having so much sugar, it lowers the freezing point and kind of takes the sharp edge off of the water crystals that usually punctures cells. And that's the same thing. You put fruit in the freezer and you bring it out and, you know, it becomes mush. And the frog avoids that by having so much sugar. So I kind of made a leap and said, could it be that type 1 diabetes arose to protect populations from the cold, because it's most common in populations in Northern Europe as opposed to Southern? And, of course, that's, you know, a very big leap. But then I started asking the question and started uncovering very interesting research. One is that even someone without diabetes, when we're exposed to the cold, the natural physiological response of our body to protect ourselves is we become what's known as insulin resistant. Our body doesn't respond to insulin, which results in like a spike of our sugar levels. We become somewhat diabetic for that cold period, and we do that to manage the cold, even if we don't have diabetes. And when we get out of our cold, our bodies kind of return back to normal. So, but the big thing when you're looking back in history saying, okay, well, why Europe and why Northern Europe in particular? Well, it turns out 14,000 years ago, there was a snap ice age. We're talking within 5 to 10 years, temperatures plummeted, and you went from like a temperate, warmer than it is today, to, you know, ice sheets. So how did the people survive? And it's thought that there was, you know, mass extinction of the populations that were living there. And I'm arguing that they survived by becoming somewhat diabetic and prone to diabetes, because at least initially it can get you to be able to kind of survive a cold environment. But it comes at a cost, shortened lifespan, and all the complications that come along with it. Now, how does this become interesting for us? Is this just, again, like you mentioned before, is this just like an idea to play with, or is there anything that's practical? And the practical application is, no one would have ever considered looking at a frog that can freeze solid as a treatment for diabetes before these ideas. I mean, it's just, you know, there's no connection for most people there. But now, looking at that and extending these ideas, it's really taking a step back and asking the bigger picture before jumping into the lab and saying, you know, if the frog's diabetes is reversible, how does he reverse it? And is there any way that we can learn from the frog to treat people who currently have diabetes today? And so that's just some examples of the way these ideas can work.
Just very quickly, let me reintroduce our guest. Dr. Sharon Mualim is the author of the book Survival of the Sickest. The subtitle is The Surprising Connections Between Disease and Longevity. It is published by Harper Perennial, out now in paper. If you'd like to read it, I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, the story that you just told here, now that would certainly suggest a way that we might, by looking at other animals, might get a better understanding of the mechanisms of the disease, and taking that might give you some new ideas about treatment. I also wonder, though, in some of these cases, if what we have here is a disease, a condition, an inherited condition that at some point might have had an adaptive benefit. So right. For that reason, the people who had it actually survived, or at least survived long enough to reproduce, and then maybe died later. But that would explain how it is that gene continues to be passed on. If we now think about it at a time where we are now, where it is even more possible for us to buy certain kinds of treatments, at least to maintain people who have chronic conditions, that might suggest that we'll never get rid of some of these things, unless perhaps we do indeed understand how things work at the genetic level and get to some point where we actually are looking at the possibility of gene therapy so that we can attack the condition that way.
Right. And I mean, you brought up a very good point, which is, at least for modern medicine, you know, the more we heal, in some sense, on a societal or genetic level, the sicker we become. And I'm not, God forbid, arguing for eugenics here, but you know, we have to consider the fact that some types of childhood leukemia, for example, which now we have very good survival rates, which, you know, we didn't have that 50 years ago, and definitely 100 years ago, these people now will go on to have children. And if there is a genetic component to their condition, then these conditions will be more common. I mean, of course, the hope is that that the treatments will become much more routine. But, you know, on some level, this is the cost to any society that decides to kind of treat and heal their own, which, you know, I'm all for. But I think this is something that we should kind of consider from the outset. And there's other kind of things that we don't typically think of, even if you, when it comes to kind of health, blood types. You know, why do people have different blood types? We just kind of assume that we just do. Mm-hmm. And stepping back again, asking those questions, you find that researchers have discovered, for example, when SARS broke out, there was a really big surprise that people with type O blood seem to be resistant. Which is, again, like, you know, why and how does that work? And now starting to tease that out. And then, you know, is it better to have one blood type versus another? So if you have actually type A, then you're more susceptible. Or actually, sorry, if you have type O, you're resistant to SARS, but then you're more susceptible to H. pylori, which is a bacterium that is a component of stomach ulcers. Mm-hmm. So you kind of never get away with anything completely, because it just comes down to the idea that most people don't really understand the concept of survival of the fittest, which is a very fluid idea, because there is no pinnacle. Since the environment is constantly, constantly changing and everything else is in flux, you can't stop. It's kind of, you know, that like Red Queen idea. Alice in Wonderland, you have to keep moving just to stay in
the same place. Yeah,
right.
Well, that's interesting, because that again, what these examples, if indeed this is the way that things worked out, it would tell you, first of all, again, it would illustrate the remarkable adaptability of the human species to their living conditions. But it also says that those sorts of things may be subtle, may be only observed retrospectively, or if you get, at least you can look at things at the genetic level, and the fact that it can, and also you have to acknowledge that these kind of changes, I'm sure, took place over some period of time. They just, you know, it might have taken at least some number of generations
for
these things to play out. So all of that, you start thinking about how might this same process be continuing to work now? And is it, could it be working in ways that, from our perspective now, would be difficult for us to identify?
Exactly. And you can kind of try to understand this. Some people around the world have a genetic makeup that just to simplify it, and they, you know, whatever they eat, they can kind of pack away as excess weight. They tend to gain weight very easily. And it would make sense in a way that if your ancestors came from a place that experienced famines often, which meant that you have to kind of live off your fat stores, then having that kind of ability to put away that weight from the calories that you consume easily is something beneficial. But today, as you mentioned, you know, times change and the environment changes. That's detrimental since calories, especially ones that are very empty, meaning they don't come with a lot of nutrition, is very cheaply available. Then people end up becoming too heavy and then suffering all the health complications that result from too much weight.
And that, I suppose, also gets to this notion, I sort of suggested that the kind of changes that we're talking about could take a long time to be realized. But at the same time, it also sounds as if this kind of process really does work, that when it can be the case that when some new novel thing, condition is introduced into the environment that people have to deal with, that in fact that might happen fairly abruptly.
Exactly.
And that the effects then would not take many generations. You might actually even see an effect from one generation to the next.
And you might even see that within one generation.
And within one generation, yeah.
And not to like paint nightmare scenarios, but just to illustrate the example that you're bringing up, the idea that if a bird flu, now a new strain comes up and it goes pandemic, and it turns out, for example, that the only people where you see, say, 90% mortality that die from it have a certain blood type, say type A, you will see within 6 months when this goes global, you won't see many people left on Earth standing with type A blood type anymore, if the other blood types are somewhat resistant. Mm. And that's probably more truism to the way evolution works, that you have these kind of slow-moving events, but you also have things that just change very quickly. And, you know, if you don't have that ability to kind of keep up, then you just won't. And when you look at it, when you look at organisms that are on Earth, we all should really be humbled by bacteria that found a way to survive in some of the most inhospitable places. You know, we're talking living within salt quarries, or in Yellowstone, you kind of see them as well. So thermophiles that can live up to very high temperature, and it's partly because of their generation time. They just can evolve much, much faster than us, and the flexibility that kind of we gave up is, you know, some of our immune cells that have the ability to mutate, and they do this intentionally in a way to come up with ways of making new antibodies to fight these bacteria. Well, that ability to mutate can backfire on us, and because these cells can kind of go out of control, and you can end up with a cancer, essentially. So having the ability to get a cancer that our body's essentially causing is the trade-off to be able to fight these bacteria that we face in our environment.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Someone listening in Tolono. This is line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to the diabetes problem, it's my understanding that people of African ancestry have a greater likelihood of contracting diabetes than those of, let's say, Europeans. Do you have an explanation for this?
Sure. So I'm glad you brought that up, because the diabetes I was talking about initially is type 1. So type 2, which is usually the one associated with weight as well and our eating habits, there are certain groups that are more at risk. And if you have African ancestry, you may have that as well. Some people have suggested that it has to do with what our ancestors ate. So if our ancestors farmed for a couple thousand years, and essentially we're used to having a high carbohydrate diet, like a high carbs diet, then their pancreas would have that ability to break down all those sugars and be able to produce insulin throughout the entire life. But if your ancestors up until recently were doing more of, say, a hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle, meaning you had more of a, sort of an Atkins diet, which was more high protein, then your pancreas wouldn't have to have that ability to produce insulin throughout life as much. And if you switch from that kind of hunter-gatherer to having a more of what farmers would eat, switching again to the carbs, what you would do, you're burning out your pancreas. Because in some ways, it may be that your pancreas or certain people's pancreases only evolved to be able to produce a certain amount of insulin over a lifetime. And you're kind of running through that as if you're running through a bank account. And it could be that that's why you look at certain people from certain populations. You know, again, why, you know, these people can eat all the carbs, the carbohydrates they want. They don't seem to be as risk for something like type 2 diabetes. Again, it just might be what our ancestors ate and what they kind of passed down for us to be able to break down. And a quick example, actually, is alcohol, which surprisingly 50% of Asians lack the genes, or people of Asian descent lack the genes to break down alcohol effectively, which is pretty surprising, you know, given that you think the ubiquitous of alcohol consumption. But again, when you go back in history, there may be explanations for this. When people first settled in towns and the water supply became contaminated, the one kind of thing that they went to in Europe was drinking dilute alcoholic beverages all day long. And the fermentation process, in a way, you know, did a little bit of a sterilization job on the organisms inside, and this is how people stayed healthy when the water supply is contaminated. In China, they went the other way, and in Asia, they boiled their water to disinfect it and made tea, and they drank dilute tea all day long. So if Asians never had to consume a lot of alcohol, you would think that there would be less pressure for them to be able to break it down. And that may be the reason that today 50% of them don't have the genes and they get something called Asian flush when they drink. And I don't know if anyone's seen this. You get very red in the face. You appear tipsy. And it's just an allergic reaction because your body just can't effectively break down that alcohol. The flip side, which is the positive kind of side to not being able to drink, if you have these genes that don't allow you to drink, you never really go on to becoming an alcoholic because drinking is just so distasteful to you. In fact, in a way, it's like you get an instant hangover. So you just can't keep drinking to becoming an alcoholic. So, again, everything in life and everything in evolution is this kind of balance, this tug and pull between different elements.
Sir, one more point is, well, talking about the alcohol now, is that why let's say, alcohol seems to have more effect on the American Indian population than, let's say, the European population settlers that came in?
It could be, because, again, you're talking about certain populations being exposed to something that you didn't have as much in that quantity. But again, with the American Indian population, it's not really clear. But there are certain genes, it seems, that do predispose you to becoming an alcoholic, but in a way this is different because this is kind of explaining historically how certain groups evolve and why certain groups lack a gene. Why would people of Asian descent not have the genes for alcohol, the breakdown of alcohol?
All right, well, thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. And our guest is Dr. Sharon Moalem. He is a PhD doctor in physiology and in the emerging fields of neurogenetics and evolutionary medicine. He is also, though, working on becoming an MD doctor. He's finishing his medical training at New York's Mount Sinai School of Medicine and is the author of the book Survival of the Sickest. The subtitle is The Surprising Connections Between Disease and Longevity, and the book is published by Harper Perennial. I think certainly we know now that some of the biggest health problems we have in the United States are a cluster of conditions that are all kind of related, and I'm thinking about heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, diabetes, all of those things that are related to what we eat, our lifestyle, how our body processes that food, and how we live. But it also does indeed have to do with the fact that that our bodies will do certain things, sort of in spite of us. Does this kind of way of thinking about disease and inherited tendencies, does that help us to think about and perhaps also approach what is the serious problems that we have with things like heart disease and high blood pressure and obesity and diabetes, all these diseases that one way or another seem to be connected and at a very high level now.
Yeah, most definitely. And I think the one thing is, I don't think people realize how fortunate we are that we're suffering from that list that you mentioned, because for millions of years, kind of animals on this planet had to face either predation by other animals or really being killed by things you can't see, which are infectious microorganisms. And I think that we made such a huge leap when it came to infectious disease over the last 100 years, first discovering them and especially then coming up with antibiotics to kill them. I think in some ways we're going to be seeing a reemergence of many of these players that we kind of forgot about, and probably many new ones, as we know now with HIV. But to deal specifically with these issues, this is what happens when a population kind of, makes it out of childhood, makes it out of middle age, and starts getting older. It's essentially like a car. If you've managed to, if you've come up with a brake pad that you don't need to fix, eventually the transmission is going to go. So it's just you keep kind of moving up the pyramid for parts of the body. The one big I think we're going to be hearing much more about in the coming years is vitamin D. And this is a fascinating story because initially it just was thought to be, a sort of kind of hormone involved in maintaining our bones. Well, it turns out that we have a very complicated relationship with the sun. To some respects, we kind of almost photosynthesize like a plant. We take cholesterol, and through a few complicated steps, we turn it into vitamin D. And vitamin D is not just good for bones. It's crucial for the immune system. And this has been the big discovery, actually rediscovery, because before antibiotics, physicians knew this. In fact, patients with TB were put out on the rooftop of my institution in Mount Sinai in New York City to get sun, because it was known that kind of sunning patients, letting them get a suntan, helped them fight their TB. No one kind of knew why, and now we're getting the ideas that it's this vitamin D. And the problem is, because of the rates of skin cancer went up so high in the last few years, dermatologists have been telling everyone to get out of the sun. And this is nowhere true as it is in Australia, where there was this campaign called Slip and Slap campaign. Slip on a hat, slap on some sunscreen. And this was really to protect a population that originally, evolutionary, comes from Europe. They're very light skin, now living in an area with a lot of sun, and they're very prone to skin cancer. Well, what they found was, the shock was, that they were so good at avoiding the sun that the kids started developing rickets, which is a vitamin D deficiency, and then they end up with bone malformations because they're not getting enough vitamin D. And the big kind of surprise also with vitamin D, since if we're very good at getting out of the sun, this actually might protect us from certain types of skin cancer, but then put us at risk for other types of cancer, such as colon cancer or breast cancer even. And it's because to get the proper amount of vitamin D from our diet is very difficult, and we evolved this ability to kind of photosynthesize. So, and it's very interesting because some populations around the world are prone to getting high cholesterol. And again, we don't know why. It's just thought to be genetic. But, and I kind of go into detail about this in the book, that if these populations have more cholesterol in their blood, it allows them in areas in the world where there's not enough sun to convert whatever sunlight that their skin can kind of pick up, it converts that cholesterol, since they have so much of it, into the vitamin D they need. And it's very fascinating. You actually see this in Europe. If you would map out the mutation it's called APOE4, that gives you too much cholesterol as one of the side effects, you would see, and as you go up higher in Europe, the percentage of people who have this gene goes up. And no one knew why. So I'm coming here and saying, the reason that more people in the northernmost areas of Europe have this gene that gives you cardiovascular, heart disease, all the nasty things you don't want, it's there to protect these populations when there's no sun. And if there's not enough sun, then having that extra little bit of cholesterol allows them to make enough vitamin D to survive. But again, it comes with this trade-off. You want to live in an area where there's no sun. Well, your body's going to come up with a way of doing it. It's going to cause you to have too much cholesterol. If you have too much cholesterol, you're going to get heart disease. So it's, again, this like tug and pull between these different elements, and many of these things are these complicated blessings that have allowed us to survive, but we kind of carry on the legacy in the form of a disease.
We have some other callers here. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. The guest is Sharon Mualim. His book is Survival of the Sickest. It is published in paper now by Harper Perennial. Our number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have several callers here, and we'll get right back to them, starting with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
I was calling to ask about food allergies and if the kind of treatment that we have available to us in America would necessarily be like if someone from Europe came here and they had that treatment, would they conflict because their pancreases were different?
When you think about food allergies?
Yeah.
Yeah, like you have a big reaction to a certain type of food.
Right, so... the big kind of idea when we're thinking that all these increasing rates of, say, peanut allergies that you see, which, you know, could be very deadly and dangerous for kids, and the reason you're not getting peanuts on your flights anymore, it could all be due to us being a little bit too hygienic. And the idea is when you look at cultures or certain societies that have gone through the development stage of, you know, having very dirty water to kind of having a clean water supply, one of the drawbacks is you see autoimmune conditions, and having an allergy is somewhat falls into that kind of a category where your body is kind of misreacting. It's seeing something that is friendly as foreign and attacking it. You see that go up in rates, and that increases. And that's kind of the drawback. And the reason being is it's a miracle that we're even alive. There's so many organisms that are after us, and our body kind of evolved for like the first little bit after we're born, we get some antibodies from our mothers, and after that, our immune system is kind of left to recognize what's friend and what's foe. And the idea is that if it doesn't get that proper education, meaning it, you know, your environment is just too clean and too sterile, then the body will end up either attacking itself or attacking things that are friendly, such as certain foods, and then not letting you kind of be able to consume it. So. People are kind of actually starting to argue now of using almost like a dirt pill. Like, you know, we immunize against diseases. Well, this is giving people certain germs that, in a way, acts as an immunization, but allows and gives your body that education that it wouldn't be getting because, you know, our toys are antibacterial and most of the environments are super clean compared to what our ancestors faced.
I don't know, caller, are we getting at your question?
No, I was more thinking about like the treatments that we have available for someone. Say someone has a specific food allergy, and we're saying, is having a reaction, and we're saying, well, don't eat this food. Would that be the same for people who have different different genetics?
Oh, I see. Okay. Sorry, species. I see what you're getting at.
Yeah.
Well, it depends because you know. Certain people from certain parts of the world are able to eat certain foods that other people aren't. If your ancestors come from the Eastern Mediterranean, then you might have a condition called favism, where you can't eat a fava bean. In fact, if you do, you die, and it's even worse than an allergy. Once you get that attack, there's no kind of easy way to get out of it. So it depends what the genetic background is and what the specific food is. But we all evolved really to eat different types of foods, I believe. So there's no real cure-all when it comes to, you know, what to avoid and what to eat. And the problem is, too, there's been so much mixing. And if you think about people living today in the U.S., you know, if you consider two white people, two Caucasians, well, what does that mean? They could be coming, they may have white skin, but their ancestors may come from very different parts of the world, and their kids are then completely mixed. So it's the so-called mutt syndrome that, all these different genes from different environments, that people kind of evolved to fight off different things from different environments are all mixing up together. So it's a very personalized thing, and that's kind of the future idea of medicine being personalized, which is looking at your genes, not just where your ancestors come from, but looking at the particular genes you have and figuring out nutritionally what you should be eating and also pharmacologically what drugs you should be given and at what dose.
Is there a place where you can have that done now?
There's lots of companies that sprung up online. I mean, the field is kind of called nutrigenomics, and they'll gladly take your money and do like a screen. The only issue is the field is completely in its infancy. We're not really sure which genes to look at and what advice to give you. But there are actually some genes. I mean, that APOE4 gene that I mentioned, if you get tested for it, and you should always get tested anonymously so your insurance company doesn't raise your rates, essentially then you'll know. If you have that gene, you're at risk for heart disease because you're going to have too much cholesterol no matter what you eat. And the only way to get that done is to get that done through like a genetic test. And you do like a cheek swab through like even a mail order company, and you can get the results. But unfortunately, it's really early to get some kind of printed profile of what you should be eating exactly or what drugs you should be taking.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another caller. This is also Champagne, line 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question has to do with chronic inflammation. I see a lot of benefit to acute inflammation in wound healing and such, but there doesn't seem to be much benefit in humans for chronic inflammation. And, of course, it gets to be a big issue as we age. Is there any evolutionary benefit to having, the kind of genes that would lend themselves to this kind of chronic inflammation?
That's a great question. I guess the answer is in the question, which is to have any inflammation at all, your body kind of has to have the ability to have an acute inflammatory response. And like anything in life, sometimes too much of a good thing is a bad thing, and that's exactly kind of what happens when inflammation becomes chronic. And, you know, when you look back in history, people were not living that long. If the average age of humans until very recently, evolutionarily speaking, was somewhere in the range of, say, 35 to 45, they never kind of had to deal as much with the long-term causes of inflammation. And it's that kind of fight-or-flight response that you have. You know, when any of us are stressed, our bodies produces cortisol, which suppresses our immune system, and our energies are kind of put elsewhere to deal with whatever task is at hand. That's always meant to be short-term. And, as anyone knows, when you're cramming for an exam or something, you do the exam and afterwards you get sick. Well, you know, your body is kind of like putting off, feeling that illness or dealing with it until you got through that stress. Chronic stress, to be under chronic stress for so long, is very new. And you only see it in animals that experimentally that you do that to them, or that are in an artificial environment such as a zoo, or humans. Because when it comes to lifespan, we have probably pushed back and through our envelope and are definitely, outliving our ancestors, at least when it comes to average age by far.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And we'll continue here. And the next person we'll talk to is on a cell phone and on line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just have a general question. As far as aging goes, we don't die of aging and getting old. We die of diseases. And our ancestors died of communicative diseases like the plague or tuberculosis or whatever. And now we are faced with diseases, heart disease, diabetes, cancers. So what comes next? Look in your crystal ball and tell us 300 years from now, what do people die of?
It's always, dangerous to look into the future and try to figure out to make any prognostication. But I think the main kind of hurdle that I think today we still kind of don't know what to do when it comes to it. We can give you a heart transplant, a liver transplant, even some pancreatic tissue. When it comes to the brain, I think, most people are still at a loss. When something goes wrong, since your memories are really the wiring that makes up your brain, when anything that has to do with aging hits that organ, it's a very big problem. But on the flip side, if your brain is okay and it is something in your body, people are looking at doing head transplants. And this has been done experimentally in monkeys. And, of course, there's a lot of problems when it comes to ethics regarding this. Number one, where would you get the bodies from? But there is a surgeon, actually, who's published, I think. He's done these head transplants on monkeys. He's switched the heads. Of course, the big problem that you have is, you're severing the spinal cord. So the monkeys survive, but, they're paraplegics, essentially. So, but some people are speaking about, if you can get over that hurdle regarding resectioning the spine, then and your mind is okay, which is like your head, I guess, then you could kind of keep on living by just transplanting to different bodies. So, I mean, that's kind of one way to look at it. But I think the big thing will be hopefully some breakthroughs when it comes to kind of how to salvage the mind that's, within the brain itself, and, what to do when something goes wrong there. It's still a very big issue, and I think we haven't even started really to unravel anything when it comes to neuroscience.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question. Let's go next talk with someone in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. I find your guest's use of sort of racial categories to describe some of basically genetic makeup a little bit problematic. I'd like for him to explain a little bit more how he's defining these categories such as Asian and Native American and... ask him to break that down a little bit, because I don't think it's that simple to sort of make those blanket sort of statements.
Great. I really appreciate the opportunity to give a good clarification, because we run into these problems constantly when we're doing genetic research, because for most studies, you kind of have to, either it's people self-identify, but if we're doing a study and people are self-identifying as Caucasian, and I'm looking at this hemochromatosis gene, so... and people could be Caucasian if you're coming from your ancestry is from Eastern and Western Europe. Now, the problem is this gene is found mainly in Western Europe, and yet these two populations are kind of self-identifying as belonging to the same one, and genetically they're not. I think when it comes to racial definitions, skin, first of all, skin color is out the window. That really doesn't tell us much of anything, because you have populations that share the same kind of skin color, but genetically are very dissimilar. And then you have people that don't. So if you look at there's, say, some genetic connection between people living in Southern Europe and North Africa. And that's just because populations have been continuously mixing. But that doesn't mean that genetically they're not dissimilar. And I think because of eugenics, people kind of have shied away from looking at and really trying to define race and ethnicity. The problem is, when you're doing genetics, it's crucial to know which population you're working at. And as I mentioned with the hemochromatosis gene, you don't find that gene in people whose ancestry come from a certain part of the world. And to define it, I mean, it's very difficult, because you can say, my ancestors come from, Asia, but does that mean that they originally lived in Europe and moved to Asia recently? How far back do you have to go? Well, I think to some degree, a lot of that is genetic, and there's been a lot of intermixing. But even superficially, there are some features, both physically and genetically, that you can come up with some kind of estimate, at least to figure out where people come from. And this is where racial profiling is very important, and physicians do this all the time. Because if, for example, you belong to Eastern European Jewry, if you're an Ashkenazi Jew, then you're more at risk for certain genetic conditions than having kids with, say, Tay-Sachs disease. And that's really important to know as a physician moving forward. You want to kind of have that information. But if you shy away from asking those questions, you could actually be, it's a detriment to that person's health. I think there's just so much sensitivity, especially in America, when it comes to these issues, that at least publicly people kind of have been shying away from. But I think as genetics move forward, this is going to become much more important. Because, again, when you're going to be moving to personalized medicine, before it's going to become personalized, it's probably going to be group. And as it gets better, then it'll get down to the individual. And we're going to see attempts to define ethnicity on a genetic level extremely important in fighting disease and really coming up with a profile of what diseases you're at risk based on what environment your ancestors lived in. And we're talking about from 50 years to, possibly a couple thousand. And most people don't have that record handy, or it doesn't exist. So the only way really to do it is to profile certain genes and to start really coming up with an idea of what risk factors are important to certain ethnic groups. and treat people on that basis.
This, we're down to the point, we have about a minute left. I have to apologize. We have a caller we can't take, and this obviously gets us into territory that would be worthy of some other conversations. But I guess it's problematic in that at least recently we have been told that science has now come to the conclusion that the idea of race, there is no such thing, and that human beings in their genetic makeup are essentially the same. Now we seem to be saying, well, we're not exactly sure that that's true, and I'm not quite sure I understand where this line gets drawn myself.
Right, and you're not the only one. So researchers in the field are having that problem as well. And the most variability you see between people, actually, because there's only so many ways genetically you can come up with a heart, for example, is in the immune system genes. And that's when when people do DNA testing at a crime scene, a lot of the genes that they're looking at, because they're trying to find out differences between people, are immune-related. And these are the genes that actually will probably be used to come up with the idea. And the idea that race was debunked by science has to do with race when it comes to skin color. But when it comes to having certain genetic, certain genes and certain genotypes, I guess the field is kind of re-asking itself, you know, are there differences and are they important? And the answer to both questions is in the affirmative. Mm.
Well, there we'll have to leave it. If you'd like to read more on the subject, look for the book that we have mentioned. The title is Survival of the Sickest by our guest, Sharon Moalem. His last name spelled Moalem. The book is published by Harper Perennial, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore or the library. Dr. Moalem, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.